Hello, it's Brian with you on Apollo Bay Radio, 87.6 in Apollo Bay and on the World Wide Web, 3abr.org. Yes, it is Brian. Bob has been called away on some family business, and I'm delighted to have with me in the studio Anastasia Spathis. How are you, Anastasia?
I'm well, thank you, Brian. This is quite new to me, so yes. We'll see how we go.
Well, I'm sure that we'll enjoy our little chat. You're from Skeens Creek at the moment. How long have you been there?
Permanently for 2.5 years. We bought our little cottage about 5 years ago. And when both of us retired, we decided to leave Melbourne and move in here permanently.
And a lovely
place. So about 2.5 years.
And a lovely place it is to live. Hello to our Skeens Creek listeners, and we have a few, I believe. Let's go back to the start. Where were you born?
I was born in Cairo in 1950 of Greek parents. And when I say Greek parents, when as a European you were born in Egypt, you retain your nationality. So as a result, even though we were born in Egypt, we were always Greeks. So I was born of Greek parents. And
do you consider your family considered yourselves to be Greek citizens?
No, not really, because although we were born in in Cairo, and so were my parents and grandparents and so forth. Whenever we would go to Greece to visit Greece, we were regarded as foreigners. So at no stage did we consider to be Greeks as such.
Or Egyptians?
No, Egyptians was actually an insult to be called an Egyptian, because unfortunately it was a highly racist society. So Europeans were at the top and Egyptians, yes, and Arabs were down the bottom. So it would have been a great insult to be considered an Egyptian.
Just remind me of my Egyptian history, but still perhaps a very strong colonial influence in 1950. I mean,
well, very much so. In the 50s, you know, it was a British colony, and it certainly had sort of all the perks of the English colonies. Yes. You know, it was a highly hedonistic society in many ways. I mean, I remember sort of all the grown-ups getting all dressed and going to parties and having sort of live music every Saturday and having lots of scotch and getting well-dressed. And and it was very much all of the Europeans having, you know, all the cream of life. And as I said, highly hedonistic society. Certainly, you know, the 50s and the 60s brought a lot of turmoil in the social and political arena of Egypt. So it was very much a time of changes with Abdel Nasser when, yes, he came into power.
Do you remember the Suez Crisis?
Well, yes, I do remember the Suez Crisis.
1956?
Correct, yeah, 1956, when Abdel Nasser was hoping for the US and the, you know, the Britons to help with the dam, and then they pulled out at the last minute. And that certainly started the ball rolling. He decided that he was going to retaliate. And the Suez Canal became really quite a point where he said, okay, that's fine, so all of the tolls will go towards paying for the dam. And of course, the French and the Britons, you know, the British was quite upset about it, and this is what it actually triggered.
Yes.
The avalanche of, you know, many wars to come, well, at least a couple of well-known wars.
Yes. Did you see any British soldiers? Because they did occupy the canal for a time.
But, you know, I was quite young at the time. I was born in 1950, and we're talking about 1956.
Yes.
So, you know, it was sort of quite, it was, I mean, certainly I was not aware of it, other than the fact that, you know, the families, all the Europeans were quite concerned about it. And look, there was a very clear feeling that it was really time to start making a move. And, you know, a number of our families started, you know, exiting and leaving Egypt. Mm. And in 56, we certainly have, we had four members of our family who went to Brazil.
Am I right in thinking your dad died about this time?
My dad died when I was 6 years of age. Mm. And so I really have no recollection whatsoever of him. So it was sort of quite hard going for my mum. She started working, which was sort of quite unacceptable in that society for a woman who had lost her husband to go and seek work, but she did do that. It was a difficult time for her and difficult time for us. I suppose later on, as an adult, I realized how depressed she was, and I could then understand, you know, the stress in the family.
Now, you're a child of Greek heritage living in Egypt. What languages did you speak?
Well, we all spoke a number of languages because there were lots of Armenians, there were lots of French, there were lots of Greeks and Italians. So we all spoke a number of languages. I mean, I can speak five languages, not fluently anymore, because my Arabic is certainly quite scratchy these days because of lack of practice. So, look, we all spoke different languages, and we never thought much of it until we actually came to Australia, and everybody was so surprised of the languages that we could speak. But, you know, we were exposed to them from a very young age, and you just internalize the languages. And you just spoke the languages as it happened or occurred. But we spoke French at home, and we went to French schools, and we still speak French at home now with my husband, Alex.
It surprises me a bit that Greek people would speak French at home.
Well, that's true. It was a bit of an unusual situation. My father did not speak Greek very well.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
So his mother did not speak Greek. She was not actually Greek. So he spoke French in his household. And so it was translated, and we spoke French because he did not. And it was also the thing in Cairo to send your daughters to a French school. So we all went to a French school.
Did you enjoy your school days in Cairo?
I was terrified because I went to a Catholic school.
And
I was so scared that I was constantly sinning.
Yes.
And
could end up in hellfire.
Absolutely, absolutely. It was not really an enjoyable time for me. And it's interesting because my sister mentioned just recently, she said, you know, I'm looking at old photographs and you don't seem to be smiling in any of them. No, I did not enjoy my schooling at all. I certainly enjoy my secondary schooling, but not my primary schooling done at Les Religieuses Franciscaines.
Missionaries, no doubt.
Franciscans.
Yes. So by the time you're about the age of leaving school... secondary school, the Six-Day War had broken out.
Yes, but by then I was no longer in a Catholic school, in a French school. I was in an American college for girls.
Oh, yes.
By the time I finished school and the problems, the social problems and Nasser and all the changes, my very wise uncle, Mum's brother, said that maybe we should start considering changing school. So I went to an English school and we started then looking at possibilities of migrating to different countries. So the idea was for me to do my secondary in English, and by year 11 I stopped, and the idea was for 12 months to learn Pitman's shorthand and typing, so that by the time I migrated to a different country. I had some skills.
Very wise.
Very well planned and wise, yes.
Why did your family choose Australia?
Well, initially, I mean, at the time, all Europeans started talking about migration. We thought about going to Greece, and we realized that Greece was not an option. We had not studied Greek. Mm. Then we thought about Brazil, because my auntie went to Brazil, and that was an option. The other one was Canada. We had family that had left Egypt and gone to Canada. We were worried about the cold weather. Mm. And then we had Australia. My sister had married and moved to Australia, and her husband had a lot of relatives who came to Australia. So Australia was certainly there, as a great possibility and good move. Good move.
You don't regret it?
Oh, absolutely not. How can anyone regret it? Yes, so that was my uncle's suggestion.
Mm-hmm. This is Apollo Bay Radio. My name's Brian. I'm speaking to Anastasia Spatter. So you've arrived in Australia 1967-ish?
Correct, 1967. I arrived in Australia 1967 with my mum.
And you're now the breadwinner.
Yes, correct. So we arrived in Australia in 1968, actually. We arrived in Australia and we landed at Essendon Airport. And then we arrived at suburban Nidri. And, of course, buoyant Cairo, we were wondering where everybody was. We thought, is that a ghost town? So it was summer. There was not a single person in the streets, and we were just wondering where people were.
Yeah.
And then within 3 days, I had a job.
Ah.
Yes.
Always resourceful.
Well, it was good preparation, Brian.
Yes.
We certainly had, a number of years to prepare, and certainly great advantage to have the language.
So were you typist, stenographer?
I was a pitman type, and a typist for a furnace company.
Yes.
In the city. I worked there for about 5 years and then worked as a private secretary for a Jewish company, which was the Rockman family. I don't know, you may have heard of the Rockmans. Mm. Mm. And I worked for a Brian Marx, who was a great mentor to me. Oh. I was his private secretary. He taught me how important it is to look after your staff and how resourceful it is, how important that your staff is really sort of gold.
Yes.
I remember quite...
Your major investment, possibly.
Yes, yes. I was warned that it was very difficult to work for a Jewish company. I disagree. Often he would say, why don't you have the day off? You worked quite hard. And I remember one day I said to him, I'm thinking of enrolling in a Dale Carnegie course because I don't feel very confident.
How to win friends and influence people?
It was a different, there were a number of courses, but the particular one that I chose was to be able to be confident enough to stand up and talk. And because I was so conscious of my accent, I thought I'd give it a go. And he said, you do it and I'll pay half the fees.
Oh.
And then later on, when I was heavily pregnant, he paid for the taxi from home to work. And then when I had my baby, he said, you come to work with your baby. So I have great memories of Brian and the generosity.
So you're a young woman in Australia and you've married.
I am married, yes. Got married in 1970. I married Alex that I knew since I was 7 years of age.
Cairo,
we married in Australia. And so we've been married about 46 years.
I love that.
Yes.
And you're increasing your skills, and I think the next thing you turn to is university.
Yes, after I had Stephanie, my daughter, I went and finished year 12 because remember I finished year 11. So when I was working for Brian Marks, I went to night school and got year 12, and then I went to uni. So basically, I did an undergraduate behavioral sciences at La Trobe. And then I did a postgrad in child and adolescent psychology at RMIT. And then I did a postgrad in mental health at Melbourne Uni. But not in such a big hurry.
No.
I had breaks in between.
And how much of this was full-time or part-time?
My undergraduate, when I've had Stephanie, was part-time. So it took me a long time to actually do my Bachelor of Behavioral Sciences. Mm-hmm. But whilst I was doing that, I certainly worked. I was involved in a very interesting project at the time when I was studying. We were looking at the social impact of patients that had been transferred from St. Nicholas, which was a mental health institute, and were transferred to community centers. Well, not centers, but to little homes that they were monitored. So this was a study, and I was involved in that just to see the impact of being transferred from a mental health institution. Yes, so that was quite interesting.
And this was about the time Gough Whitlam and free university education.
Yes, it was. And that's the reason why I actually did enroll at the time, because I could afford it with the first degree, yeah.
So your interest was in psychology?
Yes. Well, with behavioral sciences, you chose a major, and I majored in psych. And then I, as I said, I went to RMIT and did 1 year of it to postgrad, and had a break because I fell pregnant with my son, Christopher.
Oh, yes.
And bad decision, I stopped and had a 10-year break.
Yeah.
And started my own business in Kumon, which is an education system, a Japanese education system, which I could deliver from home. And I did that for 10 years. And it was not such a good idea, because it certainly impacted on my career.
Yes.
Look, it was easy. It worked well. I had around 150 students. And
how many at a time?
Look, they had a different, each of them had about half an hour, so they had separate times.
One-on-one.
No, it was not one-on-one. I had four people who worked for me, and I implemented all of what Brian had said to me, Brian Marks, how to treat my students, my employees. Yes. So that was, I did that for 10 years, and then I went back to RMIT to finish my postgrad in child and adolescent psychology.
The teaching, a very worthwhile thing to do, but was that because as a young family you were needing extra income, you're needing two pay packets coming into the household?
No, not really. I actually initially quite liked the idea of Kumon, which meant you just gave them sort of a baseline and you started them from where they were, where they could function, rather than related to the chronological age. And I quite like that baseline.
Yeah.
Look, in principle, it's quite good, but it really requires a lot of discipline, which Australian students do not have. It is very much targeted for an Asian society, and it was quite difficult for them to do daily work, and quite difficult for them to do the repetition that is required within the system.
Is this, excuse me, is this maths and English?
Correct. Yeah, yes. Maths and English. Yes.
And were these people tending to come to you after school for a bit of top up?
Correct. Yes. Yeah. Oh. Yes. Correct.
This is What's Your Story on Apollo Bay Radio, 87.6 FM, and on the World Wide Web, 3abr.org. My guest tonight's Anastasia Spathis, and we were speaking about your undergraduate degree, Anastasia, and then your detour into small business, Kumon, which is intensive teaching. You've told me previously that that experience developed your own skills. Isn't it interesting that teachers, in a way, learn more than their students? Have you found that?
Yes, I think I found out a fair bit about parents, how they deal with their children, because it was quite close to the parents, yes. And, well, look, I certainly learned a lot of skills through Kumon, and as much as I said, I wish I had not stayed 10 years running this business. Look, it was an experience, but, you know, maybe it was a bit too long. I really had to go back and finish my postgrad at RMIT, which I finally did do, and it was quite difficult after a 10-year break to return to formal studies. But anyway, I certainly did do it, and at the time, my
What was your area of interest in the postgrad?
Child and adolescent psychology.
Yes.
So again, it was in child and adolescent psychology. Yes, which I had started. After I finished my undergraduate.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes.
So what work did you subsequently do?
Well, whilst I was studying, I also got involved with the CHIP Foundation, which is an acronym for Children of High Intellectual Potential. And I worked with a brilliant professor, Brian Stard, again, another Brian, who was a wonderful man, and we did some research together. Brian was very interested to know what bright girls wanted to graduate into and what they finally went for. And of course, we found that there was a high discrepancy between their wishes and their final decision on what to do. So that was really quite interesting stuff.
And did you explore the factors which might inhibit or constrain young women in that way?
Well, yes, certainly sort of the social impact, and also, you know, what it was that was probably, they were told would be more suitable for them, easier on the long run, not as difficult.
So a big factor is the advice given to young people.
One of them, yes, and certainly the family impact as well. But that certainly was his project. I just went around to the schools and actually administered the testing and just did some minor statistical analysis. But it was really more or less his baby. I just was an assistant. Look, that was certainly quite interesting stuff. And then once I graduated, I worked for the mental health unit in Bell Street for a short time. I was thinking at the time that I might get into management of mental health. But instead, I returned to study and then completed another postgrad in mental health. At the time, I thought of working with the Aboriginal people, and I found myself a job in Alice Springs, and I worked for the Stolen Generation as a psychologist using primary CBT, which is cognitive behavioral therapy.
Wow. I just don't know where to start with that. You've got a young family, and did you transport the family to Alice Springs?
No. I went on my own. Yes, Stephanie. Look, the children are not that young. Certainly, yeah. Stephanie was 22 or 23.
Oh, by
and
this
was
stage.
Yes.
Oh, gosh.
Was traveling around Australia for 5 years with her partner, but Christopher... Yeah. Stayed with Alex, so both of them remained in Melbourne.
Yes.
Whilst I was working in Alice Springs, and look, I really enjoyed the experience.
And just remind me that the acronym, whatever it was you just used, you're studying mental health amongst Aboriginal people?
Well, no, by then I had actually graduated from my postgrad in mental health science. The therapy that I use, which is sort of certainly quite known, is cognitive behavioral therapy with the Aboriginal people. And it worked quite well. Look, I love Alice Springs. I made lots of friends. I learned a lot. I had great weekends camping.
Yes.
It was a great change to my previous life. My contract was for 12 months. I was offered to extend my contract, but of course felt that maybe I should go back to my family. And so I returned to Melbourne and find work at the mental health unit in Hamilton and worked in Hamilton and absolutely hated it. Hated the people, hated the staff, hated the system. And I had the added pressure of my boss from Alice Springs regularly urging me to return, which I finally did.
Did you?
So, yes. So I returned to Alice for another 12 months. And, yes, go on, sorry.
I just need to know what cognitive behaviour therapy involves.
Look, it will take me a long time to explain it, but it's really thinking about what it is that stresses you.
Yes.
What are the triggers? And, in fact, it's actually your thought that are the worst enemy.
Yes.
You are experiencing something, but you are scared. It's actually the thought. So it's really the cognition.
Yes.
So it's very, very different to other therapies. And it's certainly is one of the few therapies that has shown to be quite efficient, and it works quite well. There's a lot of work involved. The clients actually need to do a lot of work, a lot of homework.
Yes.
So I combined the CBT with a lot of relaxation, and it worked very well with Aboriginal people, which I was very pleased.
Yes. And does it generally, if perhaps a practitioner were to apply it to me, does it actually tend to make people perhaps a bit more efficient, functional, productive, do more fulfilling things rather than sort of perhaps brood about the negatives? Does it have that impact?
Well, look, the idea is really to stop and think what it is that you are thinking of. If you think that something is going to happen, you're going to think, well, why do I think it's going to happen?
Yes.
What is the history of it happening? So it's really the level of cognition that is really very much part of. And then, as I said, you do a fair bit of homework. If you have a crisis, you write it down where and what was I thinking at the time and how did I react. So you tend to find after a while that there is actually a pattern that you can recognize and think, hang on.
There's a little bit of a fad these days for mindfulness.
Mm.
And it sounds a little bit similar. But yes.
Yeah, it's much more structured.
Yes.
It's quite structured CBT. Yeah. You've got to do a fair bit of work in it.
Yes.
So that you can recognize the pattern.
Yeah.
Mm.
So you're now back in Alice Springs and working with Aboriginal people, and you stayed for what, a year again?
I stayed another 12 months in Alice, and then I returned to Melbourne totally exhausted with domestic violence, with child abuse, daily suicide, severe drug use. I just got very tired, and I later thought about whether I had had the training or the qualifications to deal with it all.
But don't all social workers have that stress? That's an occupational hazard, isn't it? That if you're dealing with other people's trauma all the time, you yourself become traumatized. Is that generally true?
I don't know if you get traumatized. I don't know whether I felt traumatized, but I certainly returned totally exhausted. And I thought, I don't know whether I want to do this again. I think in Alice Springs it's just constant. I think in Melbourne you have, you know, maybe a few outlets, but you know, you are really engulfed in it in Alice Springs.
Yes.
It's there in your face all the time.
Yeah.
The daily suicide of young people was highly traumatic, highly traumatic. And so that was Alice Springs. So I got back to Melbourne, and then I decided to do something different. And I taught newly arrived students who were embarking on a certificate for in welfare. They were predominantly Indians with their own qualifications, and they were doing this certificate in order to get employment and then permanent stay.
Yes.
And look, they were a very interesting group. As I said, they were highly qualified individuals who had experienced a totally didactic education.
Yes.
So you had to teach them each and every step.
Yes.
So they were totally unable to look at a case in welfare and make a decision based on clients' needs. It was a struggle for them to be independent thinkers. So it's very interesting to see how education can mold your thinking.
Yes, and your habits of thought for perhaps a lifetime.
It was very interesting.
So you've done a fair bit of remedial work, haven't you, in your life of actually trying to retrieve situations for people. So it's interesting too that you dealt with migrants, fellow migrants. What was the process of your becoming an Australian resident or citizen?
Look, it was very easy for me, Brian. It was very easy for me because I had the language, because I had a job, because I was white.
Yeah.
And it was easy.
Yes.
It was easy. And I was accepted.
But you would nevertheless have felt a kind of empathy for migrants, no doubt.
Yes.
In your work, yes.
In my work, yes. Yes.
And were they conscious of the fact that you had something of that experience yourself?
Did
you ever disclose that to your...
Oh, well, I mean, they knew that, obviously, I was not born Australia. But
because of what? Your accent?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. And I always told them that, you know, they could do anything they wanted, like I did through education.
Yes.
But the interesting thing was that in Alice Springs, I found that I connected much better with the Aboriginal people. They said that they could understand where I was coming from because I was in a different country. And I never thought that would have been to my advantage.
Yes.
They said, oh, well, you left your country and...
Yes. Because that sense of displacement dominates Aboriginal thinking, doesn't it?
Indeed. Yes. Yeah, indeed.
Mm. We've only got a few minutes, Anastasia.
Good.
We'll need to talk about your work with disabled people as well.
Disabled people?
Yes. And we're... Did that, was that something you kind of specialised in, or did you, after you've been dealing with these migrants, predominantly Indian people, what was the next stage of your career?
Well, the next stage, I just went something for very, very different. I worked in sleep apnea for a short time.
Yes.
And then...
Close to my heart, I might say.
You know, sort of supporting them and motivating them and explaining how it works and supporting the families. That was quite short-lived. And then at the time I thought, okay, I'm going to start looking now for somewhere to live near the sea. And I, here I am in Skins Creek.
So like so many people, you started with a holiday house by the sea.
Yes.
And then gradually... You made that cognitive, shift to becoming a local resident.
Yes.
We are winding up, but Anastasia, I can't leave you without talking about your cooking. I've been lucky enough a couple of occasions to sample some of your cooking. Were you always a good cook?
Well, I don't consider myself a good cook. I just like to experiment. And yes.
Other people consider you a good cook.
Oh, well, maybe so. I think I just enjoy it. I think it's quite creative. And I have the time now. I have a nice renovated kitchen.
Yes.
I like to entertain. And I think this is one of the things that I'm quite keen to keep up in Skins Creek. And I've been lucky that, you know, I have invited many people many time, and they come and enjoy the cuisine and the friendship.
Yes.
And yes.
And it's a very great pleasure for many people I know. And I know you through the University of the Third Age. Some of our listeners might not know. This is a group of people predominantly retired and of retirement age, and it's a quest for lifelong learning. So I'm delighted to say that we're both active members of the U3A. Anastasia, it's been a wonderful pleasure to have you on What's Your Story. I hope that you'll be able to come back and tell us a little more about your life at another time.
Thank you. Thank you, Brian.